But I am delighted tonight to welcome to Many Rivers to Books and Tea, Rio Oleski, who is a local author and astrologer whom I have known for many years. And he has taught astrology extensively in the area. He is the author of two books, Astrology and Consciousness, and his latest book, which he'll be talking about tonight, is A Manual for the Modern Mystic. So thank you, Rio, for coming tonight, and I look forward to hearing about how we can all be modern mystics.
Okay.
Thank you.
One of the things that I also do is as an avocation of my heart is play didgeridoo. So I would like to play for just a couple of minutes and just to kind of help everybody get into a nice relaxed energy groove and state. Don't know, this is an instrument that was created by the Aboriginal people of Australia about 40,000 years ago. And so that's one of their great cultural contributions to the world. By profession, I am an astrologer. I've been doing this, been studying astrology for over 40 years, been practicing as a professional in Sonoma County alone for 35 years. Been teaching the whole time and see clients. You might be wondering, well, what's an astrologer doing talking about mysticism anyway? You know, one of the great controversies about astrology that the scientists always throw in our face, mostly the astronomers, but also for some reason the psychotherapists also, those seems to be the two professions most bothered by astrology, and the astronomers especially say, well, you know, astrology is bogus because it's not a science. And about 500 years ago, when that charge was first made, there was a very famous astrologer in England by the name of John Dee, and he made a big mistake. He responded to that charge by saying, no, we are scientists. Astrology is a science. And if he had just been straight up and honest from the get-go, he wouldn't be having this conversation, because astrology is not a science. It is an intuitive art. It is a mystic art. And since intuition and mysticism are not particularly popular concepts in our culture, astrologers get put down. But I'm actually very proud to be intuitive and proud to be a mystic, and because really all being a mystic means is paying attention. Instead of looking at life and defining or perceiving reality according to the way it's supposed to be, how about if we just open our eyes and open our mind and open our heart and experience it the way it actually is? And that's all of life, all of reality, not just what's going on the mundane or material plane. But let's really open the mind, open the consciousness, and find out what life is really all about. So in studying astrology for all this time, I became aware that there of the 12 signs of the zodiac, what actually are those 12 signs? Well, they're archetypes. The same is true for the planets that we use. We define them in an archetypal sense, and meaning that all human beings have certain images that they relate to or perceive life as being or as life perceiving life through. So the reason astrology works, you know, anybody can say anything you want about anything, but let's face it, astrology's been around a whole hell of a lot longer than science. And I look forward to the day when the mystics are seen as being just as valid and important in their contribution to the world as the scientists. So looking at these signs for all these years and realizing that they are archetypes that we all have the ability to understand, in fact embody to some degree, many, many of these archetypes, what actually are the archetypes? So I kind of extrapolated a little bit and realized that the signs of the zodiac, the archetypes that they represent, can actually be understood as universal laws. So essentially that's what this book is. It's a book of 12 universal laws. Now I'm very clear in the introduction that these are not the only universal laws. Obviously there's many, many of them, but I feel only qualified to talk about 12. And these are the 12 that I correlate and associate with the 12 signs of the zodiac. The book is broken down, each chapter is broken down into several sections. The first section is just kind of my introduction to, or introducing you to that archetype or to that law or principle. And usually I give some sort of personal anecdote. I have the experience of this law, for example, Chapter 2, the Universal Law of Survival, which relates to the sign Taurus. And one of the things I talk about in the beginning of that chapter is our cats. And we have these cats, and when we feed them in the morning, they're very sweet, loving, gentle cats, except when you feed them in the morning. And then it's like Domination City. I'm going to attack you before you attack me. That's my food. No, they're separate bowls, you understand. There's plenty of food for everybody. But, you know, the name of the game is survival. They want to make sure they're going to get their daily dose and survive. So I start each chapter with a little personal anecdote, which explains in my life how I understand the nature of this law. And then I proceed to talk about ways of taking advantage of this law. It's funny, when I first sent the manuscript to the publisher, one of the first points of feedback I got was the person said, "Well, you have to change the title. This isn't a manual." And so, oh my God, you know, the professional says I'm not good enough, so I better change it. You know, I had the title of this book before I even finished it. It just one day popped into my head. I said, "I really like that title. You know, I talked about it being manual for the modern day. Yeah, that's really cool." So first I'm thinking, well, I have to change the title because the professional says so. And then I realized, you know what? Screw you. This is my book. And on top of that, it is a manual. Now, there's no point one, two, three, do this, then do that. No, it's not that kind of boring technical manual. It's a little bit more creative than that. But in the section of each chapter on how to access and take advantage of this law, that's basically what it is. I'm giving you chapter and verse. One of the points of feedback I've always gotten for my astrological readings is my ability to talk about fairly arcane or fairly extensive concepts and bring it right down to a very practical level, because that's where we live, is in the practical world and realm. And by the way, speaking of astrology, I'm going to be starting a beginning class next Wednesday night on the 25th It's a six-week short course through SRJC. And it's Wednesday evenings all the way through. So if any of you are interested, you can see me after the talk, or I've got business cards and brochures. You can call me at the office, what have you. It's a fun class. Kind of like this book, in that I go beyond just the definitions of planet signs, houses, and whatnot. As you might be able to surmise from my first book, Astrology and Consciousness, my whole love of astrology really is because it breaks life down into these archetypes that I can understand and communicate about, share my knowledge and perception and information and feelings with other people, because and to do what I think we're actually supposed to be doing while we're here, which is to expand and develop our consciousness. So that I talk a lot about different metaphysical, mystical, what have you, concepts in that class, again, going beyond just mundane astrology. So there is a section in each chapter on how to access and take advantage of the law. There is the next section, which is what happens when you don't access and take advantage of this law. And then there, the next section is called the spiritual opportunity. When we take advantage of this law, yes, we can utilize it in mundane, concrete, pragmatic daily life, but it also has its transcendent potential. What is that? And I have a certain, I call it a divine concept or word that each chapter or each law, in fact, embodies. For example, chapter 9, which is the law of abundance, the spiritual quality is joy. So a lot of these are, you know, fairly obvious, fairly simple, because all the universal truths are always very simple and very obvious. That's why they're universal. But most people, or a lot of people anyway, kind of look at the details and miss the big picture. And then the final part of each chapter I call the bottom line. Okay, let's just distill it down. So what's the big deal about all this? And throughout each chapter, I liberally quote all kinds of authorities and books. You know, I was writing this book and I'm really into it, you know, and I gave it to my wife at one point. I said, well, what do you think? What do you think? And she read it and she looked at me and said, who are you? I was like, universal laws? Who are you? The right universe? Why should anybody read your book? I mean, So, it's a good point. So now I've got quotes from all these people that everybody, he's all right. You know, she knows what she's talking about. You know, I can go along with this writer of this book. He's just, you know, treading on that somebody else's stuff. So that's kind of the upshot of the book. And so what I thought I would do is kind of read a little bit of it tonight in different parts. I've given this talk or introduced this book several places in Sonoma County already, and I try to change it up a little bit. I don't give the same talk every time because I get bored very quick. So it's not good when people come to hear somebody talk and he's bored by his own topic. So I change it up a little bit. One of the things that occurred to me is that a lot of this stuff, even though it is about spirituality, is about consciousness, it is about evolution, it is about big picture stuff that I think if the majority of the people in the world prioritized higher than they do, we would actually be living in a far more harmonious environment than we actually are. But that could still happen. We don't know. So one of the things I thought I could do tonight is talk about these metaphysical principles in more concrete terms, and so that we can understand how to work with these laws or with universal or cosmic consciousness in the world in which we live. So the first thing I want to talk about is economics, which I'm sure when you saw this talk tonight was going to be about Mysticism, Manual for the Modern Mystic. I know the first thought you had was, oh, this is going to be a talk about economics and finance. So anyway, this is from Chapter 2, The Law of Survival, and the subheading is called Survival and Money. The more developed societies use money as a medium of exchange, a tool to maintain physical well-being. It is a strategy that can ensure survival, but like any element of survival, it needs to be used and generated in sustainable ways. For money to function in an equitable way, there needs to be a balance of the resources from which products are made, the labor that makes the products, and the creative strategy that plans and generates the finished product. Money functions as a sustainable resource that helps to stabilize an economy when there is a collective agreement about the fair market value of the different elements of productivity. Money and the economy it represents becomes less sustainable when it is valued for the power and with little regard for the forces and factors that underlie its true worth. As such, a society becomes financially fractured and politically alienated as some groups become significantly subordinated materially to other groups. In the long run, the pattern undermines the stability of the entire social and economic order. And I wrote this, it took me 10 years to write this book. This is an early chapter, so this is before any of this economic meltdown took place, you know, but it's like, there it is. It's universal law. It's not just this culture. So now reading from the section of not aligning with this law. What happens if you don't align with the law of survival? In the Tao Te Ching, Lao Tzu states that, quote, the sage avoids excess, extravagance, and arrogance, unquote. We block the flow of the law of survival if we allow those qualities to pervade our priorities and decisions about how we choose to live. Those qualities being excess, extravagance, and arrogance. Or, to boil it down to a 20th century term, greed. 21st century term, thank you. Greed. Those tendencies can be generated by the fear that if we aren't productive, proactive enough in meeting our needs, we won't survive. Fear can lead to overcompensation. We lose the clarity that distinguishes necessities from luxuries. We grab as much as we can whenever it becomes available. Eventually, we create the conditions we feared. Being so acquisitive can be an attempt to compensate for internal, spiritual, and emotional needs that are unmet in our lives. We become consumed with greed, indulgence, or attachment. Greed is wanting more than our fair share. It discounts the needs of others and the balance of the natural order. The law of survival reminds us that there is enough for everyone. There is enough for everyone. But if we doubt that, we may provide excessively for ourselves at the expense of others. Instead of fulfilling our needs in harmony with the universe, we do so in a way that creates a lack somewhere else. This creates the karmic dilemma of getting what we want now, but sooner or later we have to replenish that depletion. Greed can manifest both individually and collectively. The greedy individual is one whose primary motivation is to amass possessions, regardless of the cost in terms of the physical resources or the true value of time and work spent by others in their production. In the long run, this creates an imbalance of wealth and endangers the ability of various people and cultures to survive. So, I can tell I'm reading to the choir here, which is good.
Is that Taurus?
The sign two would be Taurus, yes. The most attached of the 12 signs. And, of course, economics is not too far away from politics. And, you know, in some ways I almost hesitate to read this or talk about politics because the game is so stacked right now. I mean, you know, in November we're going to vote for Tweedledum or Tweedledee, and, you know, whoever the corporate movers and shakers and the power mongers decide are going to be our choices. When we lose the transparency of democracy, we no longer have democracy, but nonetheless I'm going to plow forward. So this one is what I would call the problem. And this comes from chapter 10, which is the law of karma. In fact, let me just take a minute and read you the 12 chapter headings, and this gives you some idea of what universal laws I talk about in this book. And those of you who know the zodiac, this is in order. So in other words, law number one, the law of creativity, is associated with Aries. Number two, survival, Taurus, etc. So chapter one, the law of creativity, the law of survival. For Gemini, which a lot of people, you know, the hype, the mantra of Gemini is that it's two-faced. And this is not an accurate understanding of the nature of Gemini. Gemini, it sounds like Gemini is forever changing from this to something else, to something else, to something else. And in reality, I think the archetype of Gemini represents the ability to perceive and relate to anything from any point of view and any level of consciousness at any given time. So in a sense, we might think of Gemini as kind of representing or embodying the universal mind. So the law I associate with Gemini, law number 3 of this book, is the law of both and. Cancer is the law of the eternal present. Leo is the law of love. Virgo, the law of service. Libra, the law of harmony. Scorpio, the law of eternal life. You get into these later signs, it gets a little bit richer, a little bit thicker in their archetypal significance. Sagittarius, the law of abundance. Capricorn, the law of karma. A little playful sign that Capricorn is. The law of impermanence is Aquarius. And Pisces is the law of transcendence. And then I also have a chapter 13 in here because I had all this material that I kept making notes about that never quite fit into any of these other chapters. So I thought, well, just write a 13th chapter. And the title of that is The Universe Wants Us to Be Happy. And that is, I think, a very profound concept because, you know, I don't know, I mean, I know some of you, but not that well. And I don't know how many of you have had this experience, but for myself, life is hard, or has been very hard. It has a lot of challenges in it. And so I think I think coming from the Middle Ages, you know, in late Middle Ages around the Protestant Revolution, when people started realizing, you know, looking around and they're going, you know, there's certain people around here, not a lot of people around here, but they seem to have a lot of stuff, a lot of cargo, if you will. And the most of us don't. How come? What's the deal here? And so, you know, the theologians got together and they decided, well, you know, it's obvious, isn't it, that the people who have all this stuff, God likes them. And the people who don't have a lot of stuff, you know, God's not so sure. So, well, how do we get God to really like us so we get all this cargo? And he said, well, you better work hard. And if you're working, you're not having fun. So you can't have fun, you have to work, and if by some slim accidental experience you actually happen to have fun, don't tell anybody. Don't share it, don't smile, don't laugh, and don't dance. And then, you know, we will be loved by God, and we will have a lot of cargo and be really happy. So, there's approximately the last 700 years of human experience trying to be miserable to impress God. And my idea is exactly the opposite. You know, it kind of goes back to, I don't know if those of you are familiar with the renegade Catholic priest Matthew Fox, who said that original sin is not where life began. Life began in original blessing. And when I first heard that, which is about 15, 20 years ago, I said, yep. So that's what this chapter is about. If the universe wants us to be so happy, why is life so hard and why are we so not happy? Well, a lot of that is because of the karma. What have we created, not only individually, but collectively as a reality? So I think we can do better in creating a more balanced reality that balanced, you know, on all levels for every individual and more equality among all people, male, female, and Christian, Muslim, pagan, everybody. We're all here. We're all brothers and sisters. We're all manifestations of the same divine source. So, law of karma, and talk about politics. The misuse of the law of karma can also happen when we attempt to usurp others' power from them. This is like the problem in politics, is everybody's, you know, the politicians trying to usurp the power of the people. This could be the basic domineering pattern of intimidating others so that they conform to our choices or needs. We might threaten someone physically or be verbally and emotionally abusive in order to manipulate them to be and do what we want. We might perceive life as a series of situations in which someone is in control and everyone else is not. Under these conditions, most people would prefer to be the one at the top, the one who gets to define the common reality and everybody else's role in it. But this is not the nature of reality. The karma generated by being a bully is to be bullied by others. At best, others will either dislike us or keep their distance. The desire to avoid being controlled can create a whole new series of problems. And then I talk about the way out, similarly from the chapter on the law of karma. This is how to align with this law. Understanding and working effectively with the law of karma requires acceptance of personal responsibility. Ultimately, this means learning how to accept total responsibility for all feelings, thoughts, and actions. Each of us has work to do in this respect. We may be a housewife, doctor, teacher, carpenter, chef, gardener, or entrepreneur. We might be a parent, a poet, or a politician. In addition to our roles and professions, we also have another job. That is, taking responsibility for the energy we generate in all situations and at all times. Our manifestations, as well as our intentions behind them, will create the degree to which we are limited or liberated in our life. Taking total responsibility, which is what I'm suggesting, is a full-time job. And when we take that on, we are working toward liberation. That's the good news. The bad news is we can't allow ourselves to get into certain kinds of relationships, the kind of relationships that a lot of people like to be in, because they're all warm and fuzzy. They're basically called codependent relationships, because if I'm taking responsibility for my partner, which is basically a very, very simplistic definition of codependency, is taking responsibility for other people's well-being, I'm not taking responsibility for mine. And then what I need is not going to be happening, and I am in fact limiting myself, whether I know it or not. And even though I may seemingly be coming from this loving, caring place, trying to take responsibility for my partner or whoever I'm trying to take responsibility for, I'm actually trying to control them to be who I want them to be, which fits my reality or helps me avoid certain fears or whatever the case may be. So you know, a good response when you're really committed to total personal responsibility and creating your karma in a very deliberate, conscious way every day is to let other people in your life know that you love them very much and you would love nothing more than to take total responsibility for their lives. You're just too busy taking responsibility for your own. So this leads to the other, the final topic, actually. Okay, economics sucks, politics are fixed, what's left? What's the way out? Well, religion, spirituality, consciousness development. So the first one I'm going to read is... And this is from Chapter 9, The Law of Abundance, and it's from the subtopic on the misuse of the law. Another misuse of the principle of abundance can happen through bias and dogma. We are guilty of bias when we assume that our cultural norms must be the right ones and that those people who do things differently are wrong. This attitude denies the open-minded perspective that is the potential of this principle. With a biased attitude, we do not seek to expand our awareness by learning from others, but instead we concern ourselves with validating our own limited point of view and experience. Often this point of view is defined within a cultural context. Those people, quote-unquote, are different from us in some obvious yet superficial way, and of course we assume that our way is better or preferable. One quality of the law of the principle of abundance that is that everyone is entitled to be themselves. Abundance implies diversity. This manifests in the human family through different racial groups and ethnicities, and in individuals through freedom of opinion or perspective. Certain Native American tribes, such as the Lakota, created their society so that everyone, regardless of their interests, tendencies, or predilections, was accepted within the social context of the tribe. When we fail to embrace all people as family, equal in their right to fulfill the same needs that we all have, we sacrifice the birthright of all on the altar of personal bias. We allow a group mind definition of reality or our own limited knowledge and understanding to color our experience. This, I think, has become very rampant in the world as, frankly, a direct result of the monotheistic religions, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, each one claiming to have absolute truth on what is and what we should all be in lockstep with. I read a very interesting article recently. A group of scholars, we talked about this at Tuesday night class the other night, a group of scholars about 10 years ago got together, and it was like 40, 50 people from all disciplines and all religions and all backgrounds and everything else. They got together and read the New Testament because they were trying to figure out, what did Jesus actually say? In other words, where he's quoted in the New Testament, but which of those quotes did he actually say? And what was his intention in saying them? So each of these scholars had a different section of the New Testament, and they studied it, and they referenced it, and they researched it, and came up with the understanding that Jesus spoke in certain ways. So once you understood his syntax, how he actually verbalized, you could eliminate a lot of things that were said by Jesus, quote marks around what he said that he did not say. And what it really boils down to was that this man was a visionary. And he was trying to share his vision with the people of the time. Well, in other words, Jesus was a mystic. He was very open to perceiving reality the way it actually is, not the way it's supposed to be. Well, it's not easy to embrace that vision. It's not easy to even get a glimpse of that vision. And it takes a lot of time and a lot of dedication, a lot of responsibility, a lot of hard work over time. It's much easier to just talk about the visionary. So what we have is a religion about Jesus rather than the religion of the vision of Jesus. So what we realize is that most of what passes for Christianity today had nothing to do with what Jesus was all about or what he said. Basically what he said was, go find God. Be God. We are God. Wake up. We're all the light. It's all about love. It's all about consciousness. Dig it. I'm not quite sure he used those last two words, but I think the rest of it was definitely word for word today in truth. And instead of that, the theologians over the centuries have superimposed their own beliefs, many of them, I might add, extraordinarily misogynistic beliefs, onto Jesus, and this is what we believe as Christianity today. It has nothing to do with what Jesus was all about. So when the Christians or the Muslims or the Jews or any group of people, religious people, come to us and say, this is the way it is, this is what we have to be, it says so in the Bible, it's the word of God, it's not. It's the word of some guy. St. Augustine was married. Obviously, it was not happily married. If I was a woman married to St. Augustine, I wouldn't be happy either. I would definitely make sure he was as miserable as I was. So he gets out of the marriage and decides that women have no soul. Open-minded? Not really. But 1,500 years later, we're still trying to get that one right. We're still trying to balance that equation and get out of a hierarchical society with men on the top, women on the bottom. That's not the way it was meant to be. It's all about equality. So that's why, I get my hackles up a lot when the evangelicals or the reborns or whatever, they're so excited about restricting everybody else's behavior so to be in lockstep with their belief system. This is not the way of life. Okay, so continuing on with this diatribe that I'm in the process of telling you. This is from Chapter 1, The Law of Creativity, and the subtitle is What's in a Name? Consciousness development is the purpose of life. Creativity is the vehicle that enables us to accomplish that goal. Because creativity also implies a creator, it suggests that there is a source that generates all that is. The process of the One becoming the unlimited forms of life is creativity. It is an expression of that first spark of light that exploded to become all that we experience physically. Depending upon cultural context and historical time frame, the one creator has had many names. God, Jehovah, Allah, Jah, Heavenly Father, the Vital Force, the One, Mother Nature, Love, the Light, the Universe, the Divine, and the Unmoved Mover. Some cultures have referred to this concept as the unnameable. Buddhists refer to this concept of the creator as no thing, which means that the creator is beyond rational understanding. It is not this or that, but in fact is everything. It is not male or female, but in fact the integration of all that is, universal oneness. The second problem with religion is that the defining or naming of the source has led to the development of religions as opposed to the awareness of spirituality. With religion comes dogma. With dogma comes politics. Dogma has prevented direct conscious connection to source, and the politics of religion has created the idea that the deity is simply another politician, someone out there who needs to be placated, feared, or followed. The idea that the one is not separate from us, nor we from it, has been lost in translation. This has given tremendous power to those who claim to be intermediaries between God and the people. They can use their knowledge and prestige for personal gain. There's a very kind of funny, I mean it's funny now because we're not there, but story about the priests in Egypt when they knew an eclipse was coming. And they told the people, we need a lot of, you're slacking off on the taxes, people. We need your tax. If you don't kick in more money to the priests, we're blocking out the sun. So the people go, yeah, right. They said, nope, it's going to be on this day, at this time, we have to have as much stuff as you can possibly afford, or we're going to block out the sun. Sure enough, on that day, close to that time, the sun started covering up. Big rush to the temple. People bringing everything. The gold, the jewelry, their firstborn, everything. Just, you know, it's like, nope, not enough, not enough, not enough, not enough. Sun completely covered. Then it starts coming back again. Okay, well, actually, you guys are doing fine. You know, we're satisfied now. We're going to let the sun come back. This is a perfect example of the politician priests who use their power to gain money. And so we're not the first culture that integrated corporate power with politics. But that's what can happen. We get into this religion, and we are into the shoulds and the shouldn'ts. It's very interesting, any of you who have studied human spirituality in the Paleolithic period, really any time, certainly before 2000 BC or 3000 BC, humanity was matrilineal. In other words, God was considered to be female. And there was no such thing as morality. The concept of morality seems to have come from the patriarchy, and the one thing that the patriarchy was very concerned with in becoming the dominant gender was controlling female sexuality. So, of course, morality had to be invented, because if women didn't get into lockstep and sleep with only the people that the men said they could sleep with, they were immoral. They were whores. They were harlots. Very demeaning, very judgmental concepts that really have no bearing on anything that God is really all about. So we have to be very, very wary of the priests and the religionists. So with all of that, what would be the way out? So this is what I would say is the way out. And this is from chapter 12, The Law of Transcendence, the bottom line. What provides the motivation to embark on the journey of consciousness development? It may be the pain of alienation or feelings of hopelessness or depression, so strong that we are willing to do anything to overcome it. It could be a glimpse in the totality of being that occurs during an altered state of consciousness. It could be a spontaneous spiritual experience. It could be tapping into a universal desire that exists in the hearts and soul of all people. A longing to develop our consciousness so that we become aware of our inclusion in divine oneness. We seek to access the state of being wherein every aspect of life is embraced as all-inclusive spirit. In any case, this motivation, combined with the patience and perseverance needed to pursue this goal, regardless of how long it takes, will enable us to experience life beyond the confusion of duality. We can begin to perceive all manifestation as existing simultaneously in the same unity. If we achieve this state, an ensuing unshakable faith develops that we are manifesting, that we are a manifestation of the limitless Creator, nourished and generated by a boundless supply of love. We come to realize that every ounce and facet of our being, that we are all manifestations of divine love, light, and creativity, and potentially limitless in the expression of those divine qualities. Embodying those qualities is our birthright. Feeling this is bliss. When we are ready to identify with the oneness instead of our own ego-defined individuality, when we have successfully and consciously integrated all the other laws, we are able to step into a state of consciousness in which we feel ecstatic. This feeling of bliss is not a metaphor, it's an actual state of being, available to all who prioritize it and are willing to do the work necessary to achieve it. One of the things that I find as very challenging to me after all these years, I mean, I've had a daily spiritual practice now for over 40 years, and one of the things that every once in a while just catches me up really short is the continued tendency I have to externalize the deity. That somehow God is out there. Well, actually, that is true. It's also true that God is in here and 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 everywhere. When we can open up our minds and open up our perceptive mechanisms and stay so centered and so loving within ourselves that we are undeterred by all the fear-based challenges that are thrown at us on a daily basis from all possible sources, then we perceive life from that point of oneness. And we are actually embodying source when we do that. One of the things about the law of transcendence, which was represented by the sign Pisces, that it's very humble. Every once in a while, there will be that breakthrough and the recognition that this is not just a thought that we are all one and the deity is within, but it's actually that embodiment for just a little teeny weeny bit. And that brings so much peace and so much happiness that there can be no mistaking that that in fact is the goal. So that's pretty much what I prepared to talk about tonight. If you have any questions or would like to make any comments, I'd certainly be more than happy to hear what you have to say. One of the things that's very important, since you don't have anything to say, I'll talk more. One of the things that's very important in this process is personal process that enables us to get centered. Centering is everything. When we are centered, we're actually seeing life, we are perceiving or experiencing reality from our own point of view. And one of the things that I love about being an astrologer is when I give somebody a reading, that's kind of the whole point of the reading, is I get to tell people who they are and give them and liberate them to be themselves. You're actually here to be who you are. You were not here to be somebody else. You could try to be somebody else if you want to be, because, you know, we have free will to do whatever we want to do whenever we want to do it. But if you choose, if you prefer, to be who you are, you have every right in the world to do that. The question therefore becomes, how do we actually be who we are? How do we know who we are so that we can be who we are? And that's the process of centering. When we are working towards centering, we are dealing with the two most fundamental realities that human beings deal with on a moment-to-moment basis. On the one hand, the obvious part of who we are is that we are temporary earth plane beings. This is my friend Betty Bethards always used to talk about the human body, and she called it the earth suit, which I thought was just brilliant. And you know, every once in a while it gets old, it's dirty, it's out of style. Got to take the suit off, put a new one on, and sometimes it's another suit of clothing, and then sometimes it's a suit of light. But beyond the earth suit, beyond the material plane reality that we are experiencing temporarily, we are also eternal spiritual beings. That's chapter 8, the law of eternal life, Scorpio. And so in addition to dealing with the material plane realities and responsibilities that we all have and embody, we also need to be working on this consciousness and personal growth through working on emotional health and psychological clarity, and of course working towards spiritual growth and consciousness development. If we are grounded in the body in ways that are realistic, appropriate, meaningful, responsible, and we are doing the inner work so that we are growing and developing in our higher self, we are centered. A person who is centered is also self-loving. Self-esteem, self-value are very strong. All the energies that you have to work with, which are clearly revealed in your horoscope, you will be able to tap into and utilize at a very high octave level. On the other hand, if you're only working on the material plane, you're not doing any inner work at all, or you like to hang out in the ashram for 27 or 28 hours a day and never quite get around to dealing with your material plane responsibilities, or if neither the inner or the outer parts of your life are anywhere near fulfillment, you're off-center. Can't do just one, you got to do both. And if you're off-center, self-love, self-esteem, self-value is very poor. You access the lower octave options of the energies in play in your life because you try to either be somebody else or try to be who you think other people want you to be so that they like you and give you positive reinforcement or hire you to do a job or have sex with you or whatever you think you want, but you're not centered. And at the end of the day, you're not really going to be very happy, and your creativity is limited, and your ability to make positive contributions to the world are going to be limited. And it's important as we take on that level of personal responsibility to create our own karma, realize that the person, that which is preventing us from being happy or that which is getting in our way is ourselves. So, you know, I talk to people a lot about karma and personal responsibility, and in the sense that if you don't like your reality or you don't like yourself, you have only one person to blame, and that's you, because you created it. You created who you are. You created what you're doing. The good news, that's actually good news. Why is that good news? Because if you created the mess, then you're the one who can clean it up. You're the only one who created it. You're the only one who can clean it up. Get out of it. Right? Bottom line is, there's nobody you have to ask. Can I clean up my mess? Can I get centered? No. Or if there is someone you ask, you know, it's in the bathroom, looking in the mirror. Am I okay? Am I centered? Am I living my life? Because it really is an inside job.
I'm not quite clear about the role astrology plays in this.
In the book?
In what you're talking about, in centering and becoming a centered being.
Astrology is a system. It's a system of understanding, it's a system of perceiving life through archetypes. And
so your sign reveals something about...
Well, it's not just your...
work in your
yes,
life.
Exactly. And when we're looking at an individual horoscope, it combines all the planets of the solar system in various ways and various patterns and in various relationships. It's not just the sun sign or the month that you were born in. So, as I said earlier, what really began my love affair with astrology many, many years ago was the fact that it's a universal language. I've always been aware of certain things my whole life, and I had no language to put those thoughts or feelings in to even understand them myself, let alone share them with anybody else. And suddenly, one day I had just broken up with my high school sweetheart. And that was 2 years too late. But nonetheless, I did. And I couldn't quite understand why that relationship didn't work out, because I loved her so much. She didn't love me. That's why it didn't work out. Anyway, the next morning, I walked over to a friend's house, and there was this little 25-cent paperback. You know, you find them by the checkout counter, the impulse buy thing, and it said Virgo. and she was a Virgo. Her sun sign was Virgo. So I thought, So, of course, this was in the kitchen. My friends were sitting around the table, and I kept looking at it, waiting for them to leave. So they it wasn't my kitchen, you understand. I couldn't say, you got to go home now. So they finally left to go into another room, and I picked the book up and read it. I was amazed. This explained exactly, described exactly how she was. It explained exactly the behaviors that she had. I was blown away. I mean, at the time, I was a student at the University of California. I mean, I don't go in for this mystical mumbo-jumbo crap, you understand. I'm you know, an educated man who immediately ran down to the corner to that little place where you buy the 25-cent paperback books and got one for my sign. Went into my room, closed the door, and locked it because none of my friends could actually see me reading this crap. It was way too embarrassing. And I know myself pretty well. I've always been a fairly self-aware person from even as a child. And I read that book, and it was like me talking to myself about me. And I fell in love. I said, there is something to this. I don't know how it works. I don't know why it works, but this is not arbitrary. There is something to this. And so, combining that with a very, very strong spiritual yearning that I've always had my whole life, because, you know, I love life, I love the world, this is a beautiful place to be, but there's also a lot of pain and suffering here. And in many ways, at many times, it's been very hard for me to be here to just feel that and be aware of that. So, working with astrology, to do that, I never thought I'd do it professionally at the time. It's just for my own edification, my own information, and working spiritually. And I realized over time that there is a correlation between the two. And so that's kind of my perspective on astrology, is how we can use it for consciousness development.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You said there was a great conflict between psychotherapy and astrology, and yet...
No, what I said was the two professions that seem to be most critical of astrology are astronomers and psychotherapists. So it's individuals. It's not the study itself, not the field itself.
Because what didn't Jung deal with some of the...
Oh, yeah. Jung had his client's horoscope sitting on his desk when he was in session with it. He didn't actually read the horoscope to them or for them. But he used it as a guide. He saw it as a tool, a framework within which to guide his therapy. And indeed, I'm not a psychotherapist, but I can't imagine a better diagnostic tool than a horoscope. Many years ago, I was teaching this beginning class at the JC in the summer. And it was late. It was like 10 o'clock at night. It was a real hot night. I'd given probably four or five readings that day. I was really tired. And three students came up to me after class, said, Ryo, can we ask you a question real quick? I said, yeah, sure. They said, they handed me a horoscope and said, what do you see about this person? So I said, oh, God, this is the last thing I want to be dealing with right now. And I looked at the chart for, you know, 30 seconds, and I started talking about what I saw. Their jaws dropped to their waist, and they said, the three of them were all psych nurses, psych techs. They sat around, the three of them, with two psychiatrists for 2 hours that afternoon. This was a patient in a psych ward. And five people were sitting around trying to diagnose and figure out what the problem was with this person, and I told them what the problem was. With the same conclusions they came up with after 2 hours, I came up with in 30 seconds. This was a long time ago. I wasn't even as good an astrologer then as I am now. It's not me, it's the tool. It's the framework. It's the system. So, I don't know why therapists are so down on astrology, although one of the problems in astrology in general is that it's not licensed. You know, you don't go to school. There are schools where one can go to obtain a degree or a license in astrology or to practice astrology, but anybody can say, oh, I'm an astrologer, come give me money and I'll read your chart. And some people are competent and some people aren't. And I hear about it all the time. You know, people come in, well, this other astrologer told me that blah, blah, blah. Am I supposed to validate that? Yes, that's going to happen. No, it's not. I have no idea. I don't know where it was coming from. I've had people come into my office and say, you know, this other astrologer told me my husband was going to die next year. Is that going to happen? Hi, how are you today? I have no idea. So anybody can be out there giving readings, and that's not good. But there are other people who are giving readings who really do know what they're doing, and so to say all psychotherapists are down in astrology is as ridiculous as saying no astrologer knows what they're doing. Does that answer your question? Mm-hmm. Okay. Anything else? Yes.
How do you feel about, is your first book just as relevant as when you first wrote it?
The first book is, I wrote as basically, I have these kind of topic sentence outline note cards that I use in my beginning class, you know, just to make sure I stay on track. And so when I wrote that book, I just took those topic, every sentence in the outline became a paragraph in the book. So it's a book that was intended to be for beginning and intermediate students of astrology. So that is an astrology book, and it's been used different places in the country actually as a textbook for beginning astrology classes. A Manual for the Modern Mystic is not an astrology book. In fact, two friends of mine, one who is a Tuesday night class student, are also professional editors, and they asked if they could edit my book. And I gave them the first few chapters, and both of them came back with exactly the same feedback. It's an okay book, but there's not enough astrology in it. And I told them when I gave them the chapters the first time, I said, this isn't an astrology book. It's a metaphysics book. Oh, okay, great, got it. Okay, fine. Come back, what's your critique? Not enough astrology in the book. It's not an astrology book. So, but, you know, it's based in, grounded in the archetypal concepts of astrology. So if you're more interested in metaphysics, spirituality, then Manual for the Modern Mystic would be much more appealing to you. If you're interested in astrology or know a little bit about it, want to expand your knowledge base to get into more of a transcendent way of dealing with the astrological archetypes and concepts, then astrology and consciousness would be the way to go. Okay? Go ahead.
What's the most satisfying aspect of your work today?
Today, or
in general?
In general?
In what you're doing these days?
I like to wake people up, blow their minds a little bit, mostly turn them on to who they are. This is who you are. Be yourself. I gave a reading today to a woman who has all kinds of creative energy, sun sign Leo, Venus in Libra, Neptune in the fifth house. For you astrologers, you'll understand what that means. And so I gave her this reading. I said, you know, one of the things you can do with your life that would be really useful for health and peace of mind is and even some spiritual growth is creative work, creative art. She said, oh, I'm not an artist, I'm not creative. So well, you are. Look, I mean, it's there. And, you know, maybe you don't paint. Maybe you don't write poetry, maybe you're not a professional dancer, but, you know, big picture creativity. And she said, well, you know, and she told me about, she's a property manager, and where her office is, there was going to be Ang Lee, if you know the director, movie director Ang Lee, was going to come and give a talk. So she decorated the windows of her office so that each window depicted a theme from one of his movies. Like one was Brokeback Mountain, she had a bale of hay, and she had that denim jacket hanging from a hanger, and it was just so much fun for her to do, and so it was revelatory, and Ang Lee, somebody actually brought him by, after the show was over, brought him by her office to look in the windows at night. She wasn't there, it was like 1 o'clock in the morning, but he really liked it. He said, wow, this is so cool, and she was so gratified. This was so meaningful to her, and she had so much fun doing it. And she tells me that, and I said, yeah, I know, it's too bad you're not creative at all. So I guess I would say that's the most gratifying thing for me, is just waking people up to who they are and turning them on to being themselves and, you know, if you will, giving them permission to be themselves or you know, why aren't you being yourself, you know? It's really the only game in town.
Well, I'm just wondering, forgive me, I'm using both your books right now to talk about because I need something to back up against a little bit. So, you know, I was just thinking in your manual for a mystic, modern mystic, that it sounds like it's using common language, which is really divine, to get across what you have seen in your astrology in some ways. You know.
Yes. That's exactly what I intended to do, and what's really gratifying for me is a lot of the feedback I've gotten from people who've read the book is exactly that, mm-hmm. that it was very successful in doing that, and to me, that's great.
That's gigantic.
I mean, you know, Astrology and Consciousness was easy. I mean, I had the material, I talk about it all the time, I had the note cards, I had the outline, boom, done. The second book was like, what is more intimidating than a blank computer screen that has to be filled up? Over and over and over and over and over again. And, you know, again, it took me 10 years. There was a couple of years, you know, my mother wasn't well. I was dealing with her a lot, and so I wasn't writing at all. But this was a book that, without being overly dramatic here, I felt divinely inspired to write, as in, boys, sit down and write. What are you doing? Get this done, boy. Okay. So... and that was the intention, was to just take this stuff and bring it down to a level that anybody can understand and work with the concepts. Because it's ultimately all energy. Everything is energy. In fact, one of the really cool things these days is through quantum physics and quantum mechanics. Scientists, astrophysicists, mathematicians are proving and validating what the monks and the mystics have been talking about for thousands of years. For example, they've mathematically now proven we live in a multidimensional universe. I have this friend, you know, in a certain place in the book, I talk about how many people believe that life in our plane, our realm of existence, began with the Big Bang. So I have this friend, and he read my book, and he emailed me, and he's very upset about that. He said, no, life didn't begin with the Big Bang, because that implies a beginning. And there is no beginning. Life has always existed, which I agree with. In fact, what I also say in the book is that there are big bangs happening all the time. If life that we know, this physical plane reality, began with a big bang, and big bangs are happening all the time, then how many other realms or universes are there? There are these light flashes. Some people even can see them, and most of them don't last. It's just a flash and it's gone. Every once in a while it lasts, and it becomes a dust cloud, and eventually the gravity pulls the dust together, and it becomes little bodies, and then planets, and then stars, and solar systems, and all the rest of that. So...
That's really divine work to me, to pull down those kind of those principles that are, you know, they're generic in a certain way, and to make them, you know, and then there's another art in making them very personal to the person, which none of us, I think, if we do this kind of work, can ever really do, because mm-hmm. we can't know what someone's life is.
Right.
But to be able to put it into terms that they can grab onto them,
mm-hmm.
you know,
start working with.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the intention.
Really, you said you spent the last 10 years writing this book. Those happen to be the 10 years post 9/11. How did that event and the subsequent changes in our political and economic milieu affect your desire to write the book?
It didn't really, because the desire to write the book came up before 9/11. And, you know, as I said before, my spiritual practice is very, very definite and very disciplined and very consistent. And that's what kept me going, regardless of what's going on out here. For the last 40-some-odd years, I have been a disciple of Paramahansa Yogananda. And so I quote him... liberally in the book, his concepts. He taught a technique, a form of yoga called Kriya Yoga, and so that was more the beacon that I was using and following. And beyond that, what is happening today, of course, is very extreme and not very pleasant in most parts of the world. But that being said, as astrologers, we know that everything is cyclical. There is nothing new under the sun. So there are times, and have been times in the past, very specific times in the past, where this kind of thing has gone on, and then this too shall pass, and we're going to get back to a more positive energy flow for more people, and then that will pass. So I guess another way of answering that question, Carl, is that one of the challenges that I've had in my life for approximately the last 15 years are health challenges. And since 9/11, or actually since 2000 or early 2001, prior to 9/11, I've dealt with four major health challenges, and that has created more of who I am over this last 10-year period, 12-year period, than anything external to me, because death has confronted me many times, and I've looked it in the face many times, and it's not something I recommend to a lot of people. But if you're confronted with it, and you can stare it down, stare it back without fear, then you're going to overcome at least the fear of death. And then that can transform one's awareness into a very different place, in which the perception of what's going on doesn't seem quite as dire. In fact, when 9/11 happened, I was going through a course of radiation. And so I remember going in for a treatment one day, and the technician who was lining me up and doing it is saying, "Oh, this is just," it was like the day or the day after, you know, and it's like, "Oh." I remember laying there thinking, welcome to my world, because, you know, I've been in this hyper anxious state for about the last 3 months, and now everybody seems to be coming into the same energy level, you know, it's kind of comforting in a certain way. Anything else? Any other questions?
Just curious if you're in touch with your dreams and if there's anything like dreams in your book.
There is. I do mention dreams a lot in the law in the chapter on the law of transcendence. I don't work with my dreams as much as I have in the past. I've actually gone through several years of not really dreaming much at all. And it's interesting you actually asked me that, because I've noticed within the last few weeks I'm starting to dream again. So this is really exciting. And I also, for those of you who know a little bit about astrology, the subconscious mind has a lot to do with the planet Neptune and the sign Pisces. And on February the 3rd, the planet Neptune is going to be transiting into Pisces, will stay there for 14 years. So everything that has to do with transcendent experience and faith, it's a very ethereal, very gentle, very, very beautiful energy, is going to be really strong for the next 14 years. And I think one of the things it's going to do is be bringing dreaming back, which also gets me to talk a little bit about the didgeridoo, because the Aboriginal people, they talk about when they play music, they are in, when they're playing didgeridoo, they're in what they call dream time. And dream time is what we experience when we're asleep, what we experience when we're creating art, and what we experience when we're just paying attention in life. You know, we're never not in the dream time. And the more awake we are in the dream, I think the more access to the creative and the consciousness we have as an individual, tapping more into source. Yes?
Yeah, I was wondering if you had any comments on Jupiter going into Taurus now.
Oh, Jupiter's been in Taurus for almost a year. It's been there for quite a while. The transit of Jupiter and Taurus, what that brings up really is, this is a very, actually that's a really good question, because it gives me an opportunity to talk about the sign Taurus when it's experienced or expressed from a centered perspective and an off-centered perspective. Taurus has a lot to do with survival, safety, comfort, security. The centered Taurus, the values and the priorities are about sustaining reality, or creating a sustainable reality so that everything is in harmony with everything else. The off-centered Taurus is a stuff junkie.
What?
Stuff junkie. Got to have my stuff, because that's where my security comes from, my possessions. The off-centered Taurus usually has much more fulfilling relationships with inanimate objects than they do with people, because they're very busy collecting and amassing possessions, and somehow this is going to give them some fulfillment or satisfaction or what. Whereas if the orientation is to preserve and protect, it's not just me and my stuff, but ultimately it's nature, it's the environment, it's the planet and the nest that we live in. So Jupiter, which is the energy of abundance, expansion, prosperity, at a higher mind level, or when centered, Jupiter brings in the concept of ethics, principle, honesty, integrity, in Taurus, to preserve and protect. We are dealing with environmental catastrophe. We are on the brink of environmental catastrophe, not the least of which is through our food. Neptune moving into Pisces, the sign of the fish. Let's talk about the fish, the fact that our fish stocks are being depleted. Are my grandchildren going to have tuna fish sandwiches? Doesn't look like it. Because we're not preserving and protecting. So Jupiter and Taurus, some of us are very busy working toward preserving and protecting. Some of us are very busy trying to gain as many toys as we can because, you know, the one with the most wins at the end. Jupiter, for all of its high-mindedness, the off-centered manifestation of Jupiter can be a con artist. Not honest at all. So, Jupiter and Taurus could represent a person conning themselves into thinking they're doing good work when they're not. They're just being greedy. Or they're very busy marketing their lifestyle as something we all should be doing because it's so wonderful and high-minded, when it's not, it's just greedy. I don't know if that answered your question.
Well, no, it's a very interesting answer. Do you think, like, look at the chart of the United States, for example?
Mm-hmm.
So, I guess the extension of my question is, what is Jupiter and Taurus doing to the United States right now?
Frankly, probably not much, because there are two other planets that are really creating a lot of havoc, Uranus and Pluto. They are in alignment with the chart of the United States, creating a lot of tension and challenges, and a lot of those tension and challenges are to two planets in the United States chart, Venus and Jupiter. Venus has a lot to do with money, prosperity. Jupiter, again, the principle of expansion. So Pluto challenging those two planets in an individual chart can talk about bankruptcy, loss. Pluto can bring a tremendous amount of loss. So here we are. This, and I could go on and on in delineation. By the way, I gave a talk last Tuesday. I give a talk the first or second Tuesday of every year. I call it Perspectives of that year, Perspectives 2012, and I went into a whole section on the chart of the United States and the political projections for the year. And I have CDs of that talk if anybody's interested. I don't have them with me now, but give me a call at the office. I'd be glad to shoot you out a set of it. But there's an inherent challenge in the chart of the United States between the leadership and the Congress. And obviously that's really extreme right now. And the part of the chart that represents the Congress is under one stress from one planet. The part of the chart that represents the leadership is stressed from another planet, so here we are. And frankly, I think that everybody, any of these people who are running for president that we're going to be able to vote for in November, none of them are the right person that we need at this time. You know, we need some really creative thinking. We need some bravery. We need some courage. We need somebody to tell it like it is. You know, we're in a peckle of trouble here, you know, folks, the world, the United States, and everywhere else, and let's deal with it. Let's get out of our sense of entitlement. Let's get out of our sense of greed. Let's get out of our fear and do something to make it a better reality. Let's show a little courage here. Let's act with some creativity and some consciousness instead of just worrying about the job security I'm going to have if I get reelected. So, I mean, I don't know if we're actually close to losing our democracy or if we're actually quite past to the point where it's already been lost. We're going to have to fight to get it back. I don't know. But in general, Jupiter and Taurus is going to like things to be stable. It's just a question of whether it's stable in a way that's preserving and protecting the environment or just preserving and protecting my portfolio.
Do you talk about the dichotomy of, you said Jupiter, do you talk about the difference, the centered aspect of a planet as opposed to the non-centered aspect in one of those books?
Yes, I talk about centering in both books.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like I say, centering is basic. One of the things I tell my students in my beginning class, because like I say, I go all around the astrology and metaphysics and life and everything else. I tell them, look, if you get nothing else out of this class, remember the importance of centering. That's basic. That's where it all starts. You want to really have a good life. You want to create a really meaningful reality for yourself that gives you a sense of well-being. Get centered, then it can start. You're not centered, then you're not serious. That's not going to happen.
I'm particularly interested in the two sides of the planets you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
That could be useful for me.
Good.
Okay.
Good. Yes.
Astrologically, does the concept of going local seem like a possibility to resolving what's going on? Not resolving, but a way to move what's happening to the
earth? To say that astrologically, I would have to answer no, because astrology relates to everything. It's local and not local. But practically, in terms of common sense, when the world is as chaotic as it is, if we really want to do good work and have some sort of significant impact in our reality, I think the only way we can do that is to do it locally. If nothing else, just in our own block, on our own neighborhood. Yeah, and within the self, exactly. Because that's where it all starts, is right here. And then... and keep the faith. I mean, like I say, a lot of the challenges people are facing right now is the fear, it's just being ratcheted up, and that's how fascism always works. They ratchet up the fear, and then people go, and then everything starts falling apart from there. So that's the first step we gotta work on. And the way out of fear is through responsibility, and faith. And faith is not wishing and hoping. Faith is knowing this. Faith is not hold your nose, close your eyes, and jump. Faith is really being in tune, knowing the universe wants us to be happy. The subtitle of my book, How to Practice Being in the Presence of God, which I think is a pretty nice place to be if you can pull it off. So, anything else? Questions? Comments? I think Jim has a couple more comments to make before we leave tonight.
Thank you.